everyone. Wait for our justices to get seated. We'll go ahead and call our next case, which is case number 56721, John Matthias Watson versus the State of Nevada. Mr. Brooks here representing the appellant, Mr. McDonald, the respondent. Mr. Brooks, you may proceed. Did you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Justice. If I can reserve 10 minutes, please.
You may do so. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I represent John Watson. Mr. Watson was convicted by a jury of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon and first-degree kidnapping. He was sentenced to death. A remarkable statement was made in this case during jury selection. When asked by the judge, after she had denied the Batson challenge, to give a race-neutral reason for excluding a black juror, the prosecutor said, quote, "She's a Jehovah's Witness. For that reason, and that reason alone, I would have stricken her," unquote. If that is the law in Nevada, then Jehovah's Witnesses cannot serve on juries in criminal cases. Allow me to provide some background. During voir dire, a young black lady named Anita Baker answered all the questions from the state and the defense. She identified herself as a Jehovah's Witness, but she said her religion would not interfere with her participating in the trial and rendering judgment. She said she supported having a death penalty, especially for bad cases like rape and murder. The state used a peremptory challenge to strike her, and the defense objected pursuant to Batson v. Kentucky. When the judge asked the state to provide a race-neutral reason, the prosecutor said, "Judge, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? I don't have to give a race-neutral reason. The defense has to provide a pattern of discrimination first, and then I would give a race-neutral reason." And Judge Lohr said, "You're right," and she rejected the Batson challenge. And I want to emphasize the timing of this. This is at volume 8, page 1660, line 17 or 18. Now, the law is crystal clear. We can have a Batson challenge based on the exclusion of one minority juror when the state cannot provide a valid race-neutral reason for the exclusion. The Ninth Circuit in U.S. v. Vasquez-Lopez said, quote, "To establish a prima facie case, Vasquez-Lopez did not need to show a pattern of discriminatory strikes. The Constitution forbids striking even a single juror based on race." Now, I've also cited in my brief other cases on point that say the same thing. The state claims that Libby v. State justifies their position. They are absolutely wrong. In Libby v. State, this court said a court may look at the pattern of strikes in evaluating Batson. What they did not say is that you have to have the pattern of strikes first before the state offers a race-neutral reason. That's two entirely different standards. So essentially, the state sold the judge on a flawed procedure, and the judge bought that flawed procedure. And I want to emphasize this. This was the state urging the judge to do what the judge did. Essentially, the judge cut short the Batson procedure, just like Judge Smith did in Brass v. State under different circumstances. And in that case, this court reversed. Now, please understand, the state is going to say that this is not true what I'm saying. They're going to say they offered a race-neutral reason, the court looked at it, and it was a normal hearing. Let me go through how this happened. Judge Lohr ruled on the Batson motion at page 1660, line 17 or 18. Then she considered a JEB challenge. Then, after denying the JEB challenge, she went back and asked the prosecutor, out of an abundance of caution, to give a race-neutral reason for that Batson hearing, which is now over. When the judge did that, Mr. DiGiacomo, the prosecutor, said, "Judge, she's a Jehovah's Witness. For that reason alone, I would have stricken her." Now, please understand, Judge Lord did not rule on the validity of that reason. She didn't say it was right. She didn't say it was wrong. And the reason she didn't is because the Batson hearing was over. This was just an offer of proof. So at that point, we know several things. We know, first of all, the procedure for Batson was not followed in this death penalty case. We also know we have a Batson violation because the state never offered a race-neutral reason for the exclusion. And finally, we know that the state's actual reason for excluding the juror was not religious, was not race, it was religious discrimination, and the Ninth Circuit has said in United States v. Brown that you can't do that. A Batson violation is a serious matter. It requires reversal. Now, I mentioned that the judge also handled a JEB challenge. As you know, JEB involves the exclusion of jurors based on gender. The defense made an objection when one of the female jurors was excluded. And once again, Mr. DiGiacomo, the prosecutor, said, "Judge, I don't have to give a race-neutral reason." And I might add, this court has said the procedures for the gender-neutral JEB cases, the procedure is the same as for Batson cases. And Mr. Giacomo said, "Look, Judge, I don't have to give a race-neutral reason. They have to show a pattern." So what Judge Lord did then was this. She said, "Look, you've used 6 out of 9 strikes, state, on women. There are 56% of the veneer are women. Therefore, that's not a pattern. Again, you don't have to give a gender-neutral reason, state, and your JEB challenge is denied." Once again, that is an illegal procedure. It's an illegal result. It's structural error. It requires reversal. Turning to the penalty phase, on June 10th, 2010, the jury returned a verdict of guilty of first-degree murder. The next morning, defense counsel filed a motion that consisted of 6 pages and 103 pages of exhibits. In that motion was the following information. Watson had been previously diagnosed with schizophrenia and other mental health diagnoses. Watson was raised in an abusive family situation where his family regularly beat the children. Watson was incarcerated at the Austin State Hospital because he had strong schizophrenic tendencies. And a Texas court had found Watson criminally insane in 1958. Now, trial counsel was telling the court that he had done nothing to prepare for penalty phase, nothing, and that he had just received this information the day before. And so he filed this motion to continue the penalty proceeding and asked for time to obtain a mitigation expert and to do what defense lawyers do in penalty hearings. And the judge said, "Look, this is a 109-page motion. I'm not reading it." And she denied it. So we have a situation where we have a completely unprepared attorney doing a death penalty phase, and here is how that information was admitted before the jury. "Judge, may I admit this information?" "Yes, admit it." That's it. That's the mitigation case on the extensive history of mental illness for John Watson. I understand the frustration this court must feel and many others must feel about trial counsel and capital cases not doing their job. However, I think we will all agree that death penalty cases are not trains that have to run on time. This is a case where the penalty phase should have been continued. This is a case where the jury did not have the fullest information possible for a death penalty decision. Therefore, I'm asking that the court reverse the verdict of death in this case. A companion issue is the issue of competency. When trial counsel filed his motion to continue, he had a situation where Mr. Watson had had a number of mental health evaluations. None of those evaluations had access to the extensive mental health history of this man in Texas. Mr. McDonald, the trial counsel, in his motion said to the judge, said, look, judge, under these circumstances, I do have doubt about my client's competency, and I believe that we need to have a new competency evaluation by someone who can look at this prior information and consider it. And this is what this court said in the Ferguson case. You said that prior mental health history is essential and invaluable in making competency decisions. Well, the competency decisions in this case did not have access to any of that. Finally, I would like to turn to the mitigating circumstances. If you took an attorney like David Sheik, and he spent 2 hours with the stack of documents that trial counsel had, he would have probably found at least 10 proposed mitigating circumstances. This trial attorney submitted one proposed mitigating circumstance, and the jury rejected it. And it's not a surprise that they rejected it, because when you consider the jury instructions, they were instructed that a mitigating circumstance has to be related to moral culpability.
If I want to ask you about that, Mr. Brooks. When did we start using that jury instruction on moral culpability? I was trying to remember if I used it as a court-appointed attorney, a special public defender, or used it as a district court judge. When did we start using that moral culpability?
Let me say this, Justice Chair. I did my first death penalty case in 1995. It was not there. I did my last death penalty case as a trial lawyer in 2005. It was not there. This is something that has popped up in the last few years, and I'm going to argue the same thing again to you in a month in another death case. Here is the problem. In Black's Law Dictionary, culpability is about blameworthiness.
Well, where does it come from? Like when it's presented, nobody objected to this one.
No.
This trial attorney was Patrick McDonald, right?
He did not
object to it. Where does it come from? I mean, is there case law? Is there anything that says moral culpability?
Well, let me say this. The state cites Thomas v. State as supporting this. And if you go to Thomas v. State, the language of the instruction is included in that decision, but that is not what the decision is about. In other words, it was not challenged there. So what we know is the year of Thomas v. State, which I think is 2006 or 2007, the state was using it, and this court mentioned it in an opinion, but it was not the subject of that opinion. In other words, the Supreme Court did not say this is a correct instruction. The problem with this is, once you have an instruction that says it's that mitigating circumstances are about moral culpability or moral blameworthiness, we're basically saying there has to be a nexus between the mitigating circumstance and the crime. And that is absolutely contrary to U.S. Supreme Court case law. Supreme Court has said over and over again there need be no nexus between a mitigating circumstance and the crime. A mitigating circumstance can be anything a juror wants that would justify a decision less than death. It can be because the defendant is good-looking. It can be anything. So that instruction explains in part why the jury rejected the one proposed mitigating circumstance in this case. I will submit on the other issues my arguments to the court based on the briefs. Unless there are questions.
I've got a question.
Yes.
The rule is on ineffective assistance counsel that we don't look at it at this stage.
This is a situation where we had court-appointed counsel on a capital murder case. Court-appointed counsel.
No.
He was a public defender at that time?
No, he was retained.
He was retained.
He's retained. Let me say something, Justice Cherry. I'm not arguing ineffective assistance here.
I understand that, but what I want to say is District Attorney to comment on this, too. Is this a time when maybe we should take another look at ineffective assistance counsel at this stage, rather than have to say in an opinion that it was ineffective, that he didn't present the mitigating circumstance, he didn't object to the moral culpability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then have it come back in a couple of years on post-conviction relief?
Right. Well, let's face it, Rule 250, as I understand it, does not apply to retained counsel. Rule 250 applies to appointed counsel. So we're in a situation here where as long as he retained his lawyer, he could retain whomever he wants. This is a case where, to be quite frank about it, I mean, he got into a disagreement with the public defender's office. He hired a private lawyer. Then that lawyer withdrew. We were coming back on, and he was so angry about that, he tried to represent himself, and then he wound up hiring the Steve Wilson Law Firm, and at the last minute, they found another lawyer who came on, a relatively new lawyer, who came on to help out, and to be honest with you, it was the new lawyer that made the objections in the case. This man, Watson, had very poor trial counsel overall.
Mr. Brooks, did you want to comment at all about the Feretta issue?
Here is a situation involving his motion to represent himself. Mr. Draskovich moved to withdraw orally in early March of 2009, I think it was.
The trial date was set when?
April 27th. He moves to withdraw. The judge says, your motion is granted, and I'm going to appoint the public defender. And Mr. Watson said, I don't want that. And so then the public defender shows up 5 days later, and Mr. Watson says, look, I don't want the PD. I'll represent myself. And the judge says, well, you have to file a written motion. So then the public defender took his written scribble and put it on a motion and filed it for him on roughly March 25th, about almost a month before trial. So then the hearing on that was on April 7th. The judge continued the matter a week. He appeared on April 14th, and the judge continued it again to April 15th. On April 15th, they had a Feretta hearing. And the judge asked the usual questions about, you know, do you understand the rules of evidence, do you understand subpoenas, and all that kind of stuff. But then the judge said, look, I'm denying your motion. And I'll tell you why. Because you're not ready to go to trial on the 27th. This is roughly 10 days away. You're not ready to go to trial on the 27th, and that's why I'm denying your motion. So then, he says, Mr. Public Defender, you're on the case. How much time do you need? He said 9 months. Court date vacated, reset it for 9 months.
So there was no analysis of his competency to represent himself done by the court?
Well, I think the key question, of course, is whether he understands the risk of self-representation, not necessarily his technical competence. I said in my reply brief that upon further review, there were questions by the court about whether he understood the risk. But there were lots more questions about whether he was technically competent. And just to be fair with the court, the state can certainly make an argument that the issue was abandoned after he hired the Wilson Law Firm and did not pursue, again, the motion to represent himself. However, my position obviously is the man wanted to represent himself. If he had represented himself, it's entirely possible he would have not had the trial counsel he did. I don't know how he would have done. I just don't know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. Good afternoon. I was going to start with the self-representation issue. I think Mr. Brooks represented it for the most part fairly, although most of the questions that the district court asked Mr. Watson were as to his level of education. He had a master's degree, whether he knew the law, and of course Mr. Watson said, you know, I'd like to have access to the law library, but other than that, I think I can represent myself. And the judge said, look, We're a week from trial, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep the public defender on because the same public defender had represented Mr. Watson before Mr. Draskovich had represented him for 17 months. Mr. Kane had represented him for 8 months initially. So the district court said, look, the same guy who's coming on the case again has already represented you. So basically, for purposes of judicial economy, we're going to keep Mr. Kane on the case and set the trial out 6 months. If, however, 1 month before the new trial date, you want to resubmit this motion for self-representation, I will revisit the issue then. So, in essence, the motion was denied, but it was denied without prejudice. And Mr. Watson knew that he could raise this again. And, yes, I was going to argue that Mr. Watson's election in June of 2009 to retain Pat McDonald and Ms. Kice effectively acted as an intervening event that abandoned his original motion that was denied without prejudice. Nevertheless, he still knew that as the trial dates were coming up, he could at any time file another motion. And he did file motions, but not to represent himself. He filed motions to act as co-counsel. So he would come into court when these motions were calendared and say, I want to act as co-counsel, and the district court would say, no, you can't do that. You need to be represented, or you need to represent yourself. And he says, okay, let's continue. And in fact, there was an instance, I think, the same month in June 2009, his motion to represent himself was calendared again, and he came into court, but Mr. McDonald was not there. He didn't know why he was there, and the district court says, you know, it looks like we're on for your motion to represent yourself, and Mr. Watson says, wait a second, I thought Pat McDonald was representing me, and the district court says, yes, well, actually, it looks like he's your counsel of record, and Mr. Watson basically says, okay, good, I thought so, that's what I was hoping.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Can you talk about the Batson issue, maybe?
The Batson issue. So there were two jurors at issue, Anita Baker and Jody Hafen, and both jurors had something in common. They were both waffling as to how they would consider the criminal sentencing phase. So they had that in common, and the state's peremptory challenge was based on that same inconsistency in their beliefs as to
criminal
sentencing.
Wasn't that clarified in testimony? The issue in the jury questionnaire, wasn't that clarified at the trial during the voir dire examination of those jurors, at least as to the first one, Anita Baker.
As to Ms. Baker,
didn't she say she could be fair and impartial and return a death penalty verdict?
The key thing, she did say that, but she was inconsistent. She said, do you believe in the death penalty? Yes, I believe in it. In certain very rare circumstances.
So when the Batson challenge was made, why wasn't that presented to the judge?
When the Batson challenge was made, I think the key way to look at what the judge did is that in this case, unlike what happens a lot of times on the prosecution side, when there's a Batson challenge, is usually we skip to step two. That the defense is never held to their burden to establish a prima facie case. They say, judge, that's an objection. And then a race neutral, we go right to step two, we go right to the race neutral reason. And the defense is never made to establish the prima facie case.
What do you want to establish? What do you want the defense to do? Tell me.
They need to make a prima facie case.
What is it? What's the prima facie case?
It would be something more than she's a woman.
Why?
Because to get at the intentional discrimination, we have to have the initial prima facie case. So on its face, that strike seems to be discriminatory. So what is the context that makes that discriminatory? What is the overall picture? There has to be, and yes, some cases say a pattern isn't necessarily required, and then other cases say a pattern will establish a prima facie case. But we're still talking about context. We can't say That was a woman.
How about she's a black woman who's a Jehovah's Witness? Is that enough?
In a Batson challenge based on race?
Race, gender, I don't care what you call it.
That person is black. That's not enough.
Black, woke female, and Jehovah's Witness.
Well, I think it's important to kind of take those apart. So the defense always has, and this court said this in Hawkins, it cited a U.S. Supreme Court case that said that the defense, the opponent of the strike, always bears the burden of production. Okay? So if they are making a race, if they are saying that the state is discriminating on the basis of race, if they are making a Batson challenge, then we need to have a record on what the ostensible racial discrimination is. What the basis of what proof there is of racial discrimination.
I don't understand what you want them to say. Tell me what you want them to say. What would you want a defense attorney to say so that you have to do a race?
The prosecution has struck every black juror.
Well, I've been an attorney for 44 years, and I can say you've done a pretty good job over the years that I was a defense attorney and a judge.
Okay, well, I've not been an attorney that long.
Well, I have.
Okay. I understand.
Okay, Mr. McDonald, here in this particular case, the judge, at least initially, just said overruled the Batson objection and then came back to it afterwards, if I understand correctly, what happened, and asked for the race-neutral reason.
So I think the record could have been clear as to what I'm talking about as to this prima facie case. But the district court did say, you know, in the excerpt that Mr. Brooks gave of Mr. Giacomo's, like, hey, you've got to be kidding me, I think what he was saying is, look, we're always skipping step one. Let's establish the prima facie case first. So what they talked about was the pattern. That's how they got to the prima facie case. That's not the only way to establish a prima facie case, but that is a way, and that is sometimes the most persuasive way to do that. And the judge said, look, it appears to me, of course, they're attributing race to other people, but the judge says it looks like there are four African Americans, and the state has exercised their strike as to one.
Okay.
So that pattern doesn't establish a prima facie case. Okay. And then later they talk about...
So the first black person who's peremptorily challenged would never be able to shift the burden to have the state come forward and give the race-neutral reason? I mean, you're saying they have to have a pattern of striking these people. Well, what is to the first person they struck?
I think there has to be a context. You know, and I
don't
think
what's that context? It's a fair question.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm just, you know, I don't think there's any limitation as to either side's ability during voir dire to make a record as to these issues. I don't think it's ever foreclosed. And so if you have... If you have a veneer of 32 potential jurors, eight of which are black, and then, you know, I mean,
let's say you had a juror who, to all extents and purposes, appeared perfectly fine from the questions given and the answers given to the questions posed. There were others who weren't, but this juror passed everything, so she's clearly just a peremptory challenge juror. Plus that, she's black. Is that enough?
Perhaps that, and this is when we look to the district court and the district court's ability. All of the cases say that the reason that we want a plenary record made at the district court level is because the district court is in the best position to look at that, to look at how the prosecutors are interacting with the jury, to look at the jury, to assess the jury's answer, not just on the cold record, but on any factor whatsoever. So we rely on the district court to make those assessments of credibility.
But in this case, did the district court seem to say, and correct me if I misheard what Mr. Brooks said the record is, she seemed to say that unless you had a pattern of a disproportionate number of black jurors being peremptorily challenged, that you couldn't get to the prima facie case. Well, that is not the same standard you're telling me. We don't have anything else in this record other than the district judge's assessment that there was no pattern, and therefore the prima facie case didn't come forward. Or is that incorrect?
Well, no, I mean, I think that's the district court's I mean, I think that's exactly what the district court was doing. It was looking at the entirety of voir dire and how the peremptory challenges were exercised. The state only used one against one of the four, apparently African-American potential jurors, and said, look, to me, this does not establish a prima facie case.
So the district court was responding to the proffered inference of discrimination offered by defense counsel, which was in the nature of a pattern, and the judge says one out of four isn't a pattern so far. So her response was simply a ruling on what defense counsel tendered.
Correct. And that...
And that's the extent of what the first prong in Carrera requires.
Correct. And later on is when they have the record on the abundance of caution, when they ask the state, even though...
Now, it's a little bit different, Mr. McDonald, when you get to the female juror, when the tendered offer describes the calculus of numbers of females versus those that are totally there. Would it be an abuse of discretion standard for this court to say that the court's rejection of a showing of the first prong under Carrera was rejected by the court? It seems to me that's a pretty good pattern, given the numbers that are tendered here.
I see where you're going, and I agree to a certain extent.
Because it doesn't appear, based on that ruling, that she ever got to the third prong when assessing the status of, and forgive me, Ms. Hafen's position. But I mean, goodness, if six out of nine stricken females doesn't establish a pattern, it makes it odd that you could ever demonstrate an absence of a pattern.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with the district court's math. Lawyers are famously perhaps not good at math, but they said that 56% of the veneer were women and 66.6% of the strikes were made against women. So if you combine the 66.6% within the context of a veneer that's 56%, I'm perhaps losing myself here, but I think
if you get over 50%, you win the election. It seems like under anybody's math, there's somewhat of a pattern demonstrated.
I agree.
My question to you is this, Mr. McDonald. If this court were to conclude that it was an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial judge to reject the, assuming that's the proper standard, to reject the first prong, then isn't there error, structural indeed, on the Hafen determination?
I don't believe there's structural error because there were plenty of other reasons proffered by the prosecution why this juror in particular needed to go that had nothing to do with gender. And during the questioning...
The district court's decision wasn't based on the race-neutral or gender-neutral explanations. The district court's decision was based on the absence of a pattern under the first prong. And that's it, right?
If the court wanted to entertain some kind of specific calculus mm-hmm. that needed to be proven, and in this case decided, particularly in the context of gender, where, you know, it's as the district court said, it's either a man or a woman. So, and in fact, the state jokingly said, because all of the defense's peremptories were exercised against men, that it could also have exercised a JEB challenge and asked for some remedy from the district court. I think in the context of the gender-based discrimination, I think that's a trickier area.
the record in this case is what we have to deal with, and the record that was made is pretty much what we've been discussing about this juror.
Right? I agree, and I think in general we could all make better records. I personally would have made a better record, but
I'm not trying to criticize anybody's making of the record. I'm just saying this record would seem to suggest that the sole basis under which Jody Hafen was rejected as a juror, that Batson Challenge was rejected, was based on the absence of a pattern, and that was in connection with the first prong under Carrera.
I think you would need to get well above 56% to constitute an abuse of discretion.
Mr. McDonald, let me ask you this before we get off bets, and I know you have other issues you want to talk about.
Yes.
Religious basis there that was offered. Mr. Brooks is saying in the case of U.S. versus Brown, Ninth Circuit case, that that's not a proper basis to invoke religion to excuse a juror in response to a Batson challenge. What's your position on that?
I have a few, and the first is that, once again, we're running into a problem of the failure to make a record. The specific object of the objection was a Batson race-based challenge. So the only thing that the defense, the proponent of the challenge, put before the district court is a race-based challenge. That is it. There was no mention of religion. When the prosecutor talked about religion in the subjunctive mood and said, I would have stricken, Ms. Baker on the basis that she's a Jehovah's Witness, but that case didn't obtain here because the reason I struck her is because she gave inconsistent answers.
Okay.
That was the reason.
But correct me if I'm wrong, though. If generally you're getting down to race or gender, whatever, most of the time here. If somebody is an African-American and the peremptory challenge is exercised on that particular person, and then the defense attorney makes the Batson objection, generally, what we have to look at, when you get to the stage where they give a race-neutral reason, we have to look and see if it's pretextual, the district court has, and then we review that, or if there's a proper basis for it.
Yes,
so wouldn't it come into play like religion? Brass talks about political affiliation, some of these other categories, like that, if they're pretextual there versus a real proper basis for exercising the peremptory challenge.
Well, I think the reason that religion came into question is because the defense was saying that these religious belief related explanations given by the prosecutor were pretextual, and the district court said no, they weren't pretextual. She gave inconsistent answers, and that's the other distinction I wanted to make, and I wanted to give a case out of the California Supreme Court that it might not be on all fours, but at least on all threes. It's People versus Cash, 28 Cal 4th, 703, 2002. And there, the defense made a Batson race-based challenge against an African-American juror who was a Jehovah's Witness. And the only basis for the challenge was a race-based Batson challenge. And the court looked at that and said, how the district court considered that is that the religious component was only in the context of pretext. And because we don't have a record on anything about the specificity as it pertains to Jehovah's Witnesses, then the claim is denied or whatever. It's only a short section in the opinion, but it speaks to it pretty well. And the other cases that address the religious affiliation component really make a distinction between simple religious affiliation and the beliefs of that religious affiliation that might impact the acceptance or challenge of a death-qualified juror. And so this, of course, particularly obtains in the context of the Jehovah's Witness. You know, the district court, after the prosecutor said, I've never seen a Jehovah's Witness say that not only can they sit in a guilt phase, they can assess penalty. And Judge Lohr says, in 16 years on the bench, neither have I.
So if the witness had been, let's say, a Catholic or a Presbyterian or a Jewish or something, would any of this
The example I'm given is if a prosecutor exercised a peremptory challenge against me after I filled out a juror questionnaire and said I was a Zoroastrian, okay?
Okay.
So the prosecutor doesn't know anything except my religious affiliation. They don't know anything about Zoroastrianism. And they strike me on the simple basis, they get up, there's a challenge based on religious affiliation, and the district court says, there's a prima facie case, offer me something that's religion neutral, and he says, I just struck him because he's a Zoroastrian. I don't know anything about him. You know?
Okay.
Or if the prosecutor says, look, I know from experience that that ancient Persian religion, they cannot sit in a penalty phase. They cannot sit in judgment of others, and they certainly do not feel that it's their place, accordance with their religious values, to issue a penalty. And that's why I struck them. Then that's the difference between simple religious affiliation, discrimination on that basis, and the religious belief component of that affiliation. And I think that's what happens here, although I don't think we get there because there was no record made on that issue.
Thank you.
You want to talk about the moral culpability instruction?
Sure. This is another plain error issue. You know, the defense didn't object, and I thought I had the proposed defense instructions, and I would urge the court, when they're looking at this issue, to look at the rejected instructions proposed by the defense, because I'm 60% sure that the moral culpability instruction is in their offered instructions, and there are case citations in there, although I can't be certain on that, and I wish that I had it here with me. But otherwise, you know, jury instruction error is one of those, and I know I've argued this here before, that I think is particularly incapable of plain error review. You know, unless it's a clear, a clear misstatement of the law, I don't think that we can do plain error because, you know, defense attorneys have, you know, certain strategies for offering certain instructions and not other instructions, and we can't know those strategies or objecting to certain instructions that were offered by the state. Of course, I don't know where the moral culpability instruction comes from any more than you or Mr. Brooks.
That's what we're worried about. You just don't know where it comes from.
I don't personally know. I know that it was at least referenced in Thomas. And that is something, of course, this court could alter prospectively if it were so inclined.
Thank you.
How do you justify it, though, moral culpability, in reading what Mr. Brooks has said in his briefs about Black's Law Dictionary and how it views, and does it take away from a jury finding any mitigation at all when you talk about moral culpability when you have these horrendous, brutal murder cases?
Well, I don't think so, because I think moral culpability strikes at the very core of the matter. That is exactly what a defense attorney would want to mitigate, is moral culpability. Whether the defendant stubbed his toe this morning or was good looking could possibly be offered as a mitigating circumstance. But it doesn't, I don't know how compelling it would be to a jury when they have the aggravators of first-degree kidnapping and mutilation and the facts specifically in this case. I don't know how that would make any difference. So, do I have 5 minutes? Is that my time?
Yep. Five and a half minutes.
Okay. Unless anyone has anything else of interest.
Was it an abuse of discretion to deny the motion to continue the penalty phase?
I did want to talk about that. The court has broad discretion, especially in the very middle of trial, to grant or deny a motion to continue. There are, I think Mr. Brooks was getting into issues of ineffective assistance of counsel, and I don't really need to get into those.
Well, I'd like you to get into it, because I think in this case it screams out. And I just think that sometimes, you know, when Patrick McDonald takes the stand and the DA tries to present him as a great criminal defense attorney, I don't know how he can do it with a straight face in this particular case. And maybe it's time that we take a look at it when we have a situation like this, that we just say there was ineffective assistance of counsel. I know that maybe my colleagues would think we need to have that in the district court make certain findings, but from what Mr. Brooks said, I don't think Patrick did such a great job in this case. And this is a death penalty case, for God's sakes.
I see where you're going, and but in the end, it comes down to prejudice. And in this specific context, the motion to continue was because of these, you know, the mitigation reports that he got that very day. The mitigation reports about his being found insane over 50 years ago, his being committed twice because of two suicide attempts, his 14-month commitment after one of the suicide attempts, and I think two additional 90-day commitments, all back when he was in his 20s. All of that was offered by stipulation, and it wasn't admitted, okay? If you'd like me to read the entire stipulation, I could, but...
How about just the record site, Mr. McDonald?
Sure. It's 12 ROA 2726. And essentially, they stipulated in front of the jury that the jury was to find all of those conclusively proven, as a matter of fact, in mitigation, all of the factors that I just cited. They also agreed in stipulation that in 2008, Mr. Watson was found to be competent and had no mental disease or defect. That was read in front of the jury to the jury, and they considered that in their verdict. It wasn't simply thrown into the record, as it were. Also, Mr. Watson never wanted a mitigation case. He time and time again said he didn't want Mr. McDonald to offer a mitigation case. And if we're looking at the deficiency prong in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, then we have to look at, well, his client said, I don't want a mitigation case. My Muslim faith requires that if I am found guilty, I be put to death. And then the defendant stood up and allocuted and asked the jury for a sentence of death. So, in essence, there's no prejudice. So I have 1 minute, unless there's anything else.
Questions for Mr. McDonald? Thank you.
I think the overwhelming circumstantial evidence, as far as the facts of the case, are well presented in the briefs, and I will submit it on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Mr. Brooks.
There was a stipulation regarding the competency evaluation by a doctor from Lakes Crossing. And that doctor had no access to the extensive mental health history of this man. I will also say this, counsel is correct. John Watson apparently did not want mitigation provided to the jury. I will also say this. I've never had a coherent conversation with a man, and I don't think he's competent today. And I believe that had I been the lawyer in that case, and I think any decent lawyer would have done it, you would have prepared a mitigation case regardless. And here is why. Ultimately, we all have a responsibility in these very serious cases to have a record made that allows the jury to make an informed decision about this unbelievable crime and what punishment should occur.
Mr. Brooks, yes. I understand your statement of preparing a mitigation case. It would only be for a proffer because, again, it is the defendant's case. It's not the lawyer's case, which gets to be the troubling factor when we talk about this.
We have discussions about this, and I will just tell you, Justice Douglas, maybe I'm wrong, but I believe that defense counsel has a duty to present a mitigation case regardless to the jury.
Even if the client says no?
Yes, I believe that. And maybe I'm wrong, but I believe that.
Would that give the client the right to fire you on the spot?
Possibly. Maybe he would take over the case and present less or different than I would. But it's my understanding that my obligation is to present a mitigation case. I will also say that there's no doubt in this case the jury did not get the full picture of Mr. Watson's past. So I would like to address briefly a statement that the gentleman from the DA's office made. He says that the DA's made an argument at the district court level regarding Batson on the inconsistent answers provided by Ms. Baker. That did not happen. It's not there. If you look at pages 1660 through 1662, it never happened. They cut short that discussion with their insistence on the pattern of discrimination. I also would say, since these representations have been made here, that if you go back to page 1409 through 1412 and look at the actual words that came out of Anita Baker's mouth, there is no inconsistency at all. She's a very thoughtful woman, and she explained that she believed in the death penalty for the most severe crimes of rape and murder, which I think is pretty close to what the law is. Not exactly, but pretty close. The only inconsistencies are inconsistencies posed by Mr. DiGiacomo, which they really are not inconsistencies at all. Her answers make total sense. I urge you to look at 1409 through 1412. It explains it quite clearly. Also, I will just address this briefly. I think that there is always a frustration, especially in Batson, regarding the record made in district court. If you look at the universe of information available to the defense attorney who is making the Batson objection, he essentially has four possible areas. The fact that a strike was made against a minority. The fact that the record of questions to that juror do not support a reason to knock her off. Then you get to a possible pattern of discrimination in strikes, and then you get to comparative juror analysis. I'm not smart enough to do a comparative juror analysis there when I'm trying to do all these other things during jury selection. I can't do it. It's too much information. As far as the pattern goes, if the pattern of strikes is there, it helps the Batson claim. If the pattern of strikes is not there, it doesn't necessarily end the Batson issue. Realistically, in most of these cases, the person making the Batson objection really is going on two things. The fact that a minority was eliminated and the fact that her questions didn't suggest a reason. That's why...
Yes. In Ford versus State, we made very clear, quote, the opponent of the peremptory challenge, first prong, must make a prima facie case of discrimination. It doesn't have to be demonstrated by a pattern, but it has to be a prima facie case of discrimination such that relevant facts show an inference of discriminatory purpose. That's the rule.
I agree.
That's the first prong.
I agree. And I submit that is satisfied by striking a minority juror with no information from the colloquy with the juror that would suggest she should be stricken.
Don't you think defense counsel should at least say that much?
They should. They should. And I'll also tell you that probably 90% do not.
I think we're lucky in this case that even made the Batson challenge.
You're exactly correct, Justice Cherry. Let me say this in my closing statement here. The Missouri Supreme Court took a look at Batson cases in
State v. Antwine, an old case. They said, look, we can't figure these things out without the state making a race-neutral reason. And I think that's true today. You can't figure this stuff out without the state doing that. And if we ever get to the point where public policy is allowing the state to just cut it off, then it's the end of Batson. I think that's a bad thing. I'll submit it.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Mr. McDonald, appreciate your arguments and briefs. And again, it's a pleasure to see both of you up here in Carson City. I know you're both based in Las Vegas now. It's nice to see you. Like that. Okay. And the court will be in recess until the next call.